The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com. The Fern Line is also supported by the Moose's Tooth Pub and Pizzeria. Moose's Tooth has been a hub of the Anchorage community since 1996, offering a great selection of mouthwatering pizzas and salads, award-winning handcrafted beers, and incredible live concerts. To peruse the menu or find out more about upcoming live events, check the Moose's Tooth out online at moosestooth.net.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need, from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town, or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On season two, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. Before we dive in, I just want to say thank you so much to everyone who continues to support this show on Patreon every month. I had two or three new backers again in the last couple weeks, and every contribution helps to ensure that this podcast remains a sustainable and viable endeavor for me moving forward. So if you are interested in becoming a backer on Patreon, you can go to thefernline.com. Click on Support the Fern Line, and you will be directed to the relevant links. Other ways you can support this show are by leaving a review on iTunes or from within your favorite podcast app. You can tell someone directly, tell your friends, your coworkers, your climbing partners, people you think might dig the Fern Line. Please let them know it's out there. And if you want to get in touch, you can email me directly at thefernline@gmail.com. I look very forward to hearing from all of you. And I love getting emails and having that added connection with all of my listeners. All right. So with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or frigid snow cave on the Cassine Ridge and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. When I think back to my formative time as a young Alaskan climber, I'm often filled with memories and nostalgia that are overwhelming. The wonder I felt when I first roped up to cross a boundless ice field littered with crevasses and dotted with saber-like nunataks. My first uneasy solo climb up a 2,000-foot ice face in the western Chugach. Seeing my life flash before my eyes when a river crossing went bad, sending me through a turbulent cauldron of boulders and snags, only to walk away unscathed. And the first time I felt the cold finality of death when my 19-year-old friend was buried under 15 feet of snow in Hatcher Pass. Like many young alpinists, my experiences in and out of the mountains were defined by a succession of monumental highs tempered with desperate lows. Maybe that's why Jonathan Waterman's book, In the Shadow of Denali, made such an indelible mark on me. The collection of short stories, which is a mountaineering classic, followed Waterman's years as an alpinist and mountaineering ranger on Denali in the 1970s and 80s. As a neophyte Alaskan climber just out of high school, it affected me deeply. Although I was fascinated with the climbing stories Waterman penned, I was equally entranced by the characters he described. Tales of legendary figures like Mug Stump and Ray Janay kept me turning the pages at a frantic pace. But it was the stories of the people living their lives in the shadow of the mountain that hit me the hardest. The descriptions of the hard-drinking Herb Atwater and the ill-fated journey of Greta Berglund painted a brutally honest picture of a darker side of Alaska. Needless to say, the book left a lasting impression on me, and I can honestly say that even today, In the Shadow of Denali is the most influential climbing-related book I've ever read. That's why I was excited to get a chance to interview Jonathan Waterman this last week. We talked about everything, from his bitter 1982 winter ascent on the Cassine Ridge to a 2,000-mile paddle trip across the Northwest Passage, as well as his new book, Chasing Denali. We started our conversation by talking about Waterman's first forays into the outdoors as a teenager and how that led to his first experience on Denali.
Well, I was drawn as a 12-year-old to the Outward Bound School, which is really probably the singular inspiration of my young life. And I couldn't go to Outward Bound as a 12-year-old. You have to wait until you turn 16 and a half. And as soon as I did, there I was up and running. And even though I was an athlete in high school, I was disenchanted with it. So this was the perfect outlet, but not only because I found a new way to express myself in non-competitive ways as a climber and learning sort of deeper outdoor craft, if you will, you know, camp craft and backpacking. At any rate, my attraction to the Outward Bound experience as a 16-year-old was that there was no competition, and it was the overt competition, the brutality of playing football and even running track that weren't working for me. But in being in the outdoors for days at a time and learning a sense of self-reliance was really important to me. Moreover, I had some very strong mentors. One was my instructor, who happened to be a woman. And it wasn't just that she was a good climber and a crafty, you know, skilled person in the woods. She was also an intellect, you know, and she constantly talked of books and travel and other cultures. And so I was drawn into this world like I was stuck on a magnet. And there was even another mentor in that experience. He was our guide for a 3-day trip down the Chattooga River during that Outward Bound course, Payson Kennedy. He owned the Nantahala Outdoor Center. And as a 16-year-old at the time in 1973, I'd just seen the movie Deliverance. And for a 16-year-old boy at that point in time in America, you know, most 16-year-old boys were lionizing Burt Reynolds, who was the star of that movie. But Payson Kennedy was, in fact, the stuntman for Burt Reynolds in that movie, Deliverance. And it quickly became apparent to me that this guy was the real goods. He could do things that Burt Reynolds could only pretend to do as an actor.
Right.
And so that kind of role model to me was very powerful. And I think that as climbers in particular, it's helpful to have those kinds of figures.
Absolutely. So I know that, you know, at some point in time, you made your way up to Alaska as a teenager and onto the flanks of Denali. How did that all come about?
Well, that came about because there was a dedicated man in my town who ran the Explorers Post, the more mature version of the Boy Scouts. And we didn't pretend to want to wear uniforms or anything like that, but I think we had some funding from Boy Scouts of America. And mostly we spent our time up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, camping, backpacking in the winter in places like the Presidentials, which is a great place to learn winter survival skills. Probably one of, it's as good as Alaska in terms of learning how to deal with wind and cold and build igloos, or it's an approximation of Alaska anyways. And so to bring that story to Alaska, we had the very ambitious goal of climbing Denali in 1976, which happened to be the bicentennial year. And we were from Lexington, Massachusetts. So that allowed us to raise the money for our airplane tickets. And the eight of us were 18, 19, 20 in that age range, gave Denali a shot on the West Buttress. And it was a great learning experience. We didn't have any guides. We knew how to dig in. We had our acts together, but it was a great spanking, frankly, because I can't speak for the rest of my group, but right away I saw that there was another way to do this type of climb. As we started out at landing strip on the southeast fork of the Cahokia. We had just been flown in, and we had a big pile of boxes with, you know, spare ice axe for the spare ice axe, just outfitted to the teeth. And in comes this lone figure skiing up Heartbreak Hill, unroped, obviously, by himself. And he's got a sled with maybe, you know, four or five packages of freeze-dried food. He ended up giving them all to us out of sympathy. And his name was Reinhold Messner.
Right.
And I had already read his books, and I was so shamefaced. We were only on the mountain a few hours, and I realized that we were doing it all wrong. And so the rest of the trip was, I just had that in my craw the whole way. We learned a lot. We played it safe, and we didn't leave anything behind. I think we hauled it all off. I think my back is probably still sore from that a half century later.
Right.
And it instilled in me the ideal of traveling light and fast.
Yeah.
That vision of Reinhold Messner skiing alone up the glacier. And that's really what I really longed to do. So I began to go on expeditions and climbs that were much more alpine style, which was just then in the 70s, of course, sort of sweeping the world, although most people were still kind of stuck in more ponderous expedition style. So
right.
Denali happened to be where I learned those things. I didn't go back to Denali for another 5 years, but in that time away, I went to another great Alaskan mountain and went to the Himalayas and places where I learned the craft of climbing quickly without being encumbered with a lot of gear.
So when you think back to that time in your life, what were the most impactful experiences that you had in that time frame that had to do with the outdoors and just, I guess, life in general?
I, of course, worked for the Colorado Outward Bound School. I did a brief stint for the Northwest Outward Bound School. And that was a really important time in my life, too, because I spent time with a lot of like-minded people who I went into the mountains with, not only on these courses, but certainly after the courses, and became absolutely comfortable being a complete and total dirtbag. And not having a place to live other than the Ansellite pad that I carried around. And that lifestyle was everything in terms of inspiration. But I always went back to, in my head, in my imaginings, to Alaska. No matter where I was climbing or what mountains I was visiting, Alaska to me was the place of the heart, partly because of that first experience, but also just because those mountains are like nothing else in the world, the extent of the glaciation and the tremendous vertical relief and just the wilderness aspects of Alaskan mountains. And I'm not referring to Denali alone. I'm very fond of the Wrangell St. Elias mountains and just being in the north in general. So to me, it was never, I went to Denali repeatedly, and I happen to have written a lot about it, but there are so many other places I went in the north. To me, it was about being in the far north, you know, in the north subarctic or the Arctic. And when I was young, it happened to be a lot more mountaineering, and then I turned more and more toward doing trips in the Arctic.
Building on his experience from the 1976 Denali trip, Waterman continued to fortify his skill set in the mountains, working as an Outward Bound instructor, then as a National Park Service employee in Rocky Mountain National Park. Eventually, Denali would become the driving force in his life, and he would spend multiple seasons, first working as a guide, then a mountaineering ranger for the Park Service. I asked Jonathan to talk about these early days on the mountain, some of the characters he encountered, and how those experiences would influence his later writings about Denali.
I was not really the quintessential Park Service person, and I happened to have gotten a job for Rocky Mountain National Park as a backcountry ranger, and not having any experience at all with the Park Service, I think they just wanted another climber because they typically had a lot of rescues there. And I enjoyed myself, but I was recommended only in competition. In other words, I didn't get good references from that job. But I had been to Denali several times, and the fourth time I went back in the winter and climbed Denali in the wintertime, and the same opportunity came my way the year after working at Rocky Mountain National Park, because I had this extensive and very extreme experience on Denali after climbing the Kasin Ridge in winter. I was offered a job yet again. And that, as I said, was an absolute dream job for me, because we rarely wore uniforms. We were sort of inventing the protocols back then in the early 80s and did things on a shoestring, would just hire helicopter pilots out of Anchorage to go in and scoop people up who were on death's doorstep. Moreover, go get them ourselves when we were up on the mountain. And
right.
It was the most intense period of my life, those 3 years that I worked as a Denali ranger. And part of the richness of the experience, frankly, was about all friends that came by climbing in the range or on Denali and making new friends. It was a very social experience, as anyone who climbs the West Buttress of Denali would quickly agree.
Yeah. When you think back to your time, you know, like hanging out in Talkeetna, like was this in the 80s?
Yeah, I was there in 81 and then guiding briefly. And then I had a job 82, 83 and 84 as a Park Service ranger.
Right.
So it was the early 80s, but I stayed in Alaska.
Yeah.
a couple of years after that, too.
Can you just kind of talk about the culture of Talkeetna in Denali during that time? Because there's something about that time, even though it was before when I was climbing, it just sounds like a really nostalgic time to me. And
yeah, I think I can, because I have the advantage of having just been there at least 2 years ago after not having been there for nearly a quarter of a century. And so by comparison, it was somewhat of a frontier. I mean, it was much more of a frontier in 1976 when there were really no rangers to speak of on the mountain. So from my standpoint and my job as a ranger, it was a frontier because we were figuring out how to do rescues. And we had, you know, most of our rescue protocol was just things that we'd learned on our own. We didn't have any formal training at that point. And we would group together friends to lower people down off of a mountain, for instance, if they were sick or dying or dead in some cases. But the mountain, you know, it wasn't a frontier in the other respect, just if you were on the mountain, because when I was on the mountain, I never really felt like I was a ranger. I felt like I was just there to help people, and I was always surrounded by this great family. And it was a time that was a frontier, I guess, in respect of there were a lot of opportunities to climb new routes or to climb them quickly. And those opportunities don't exist anymore like they did in the early 80s. Not only in the early 80s were there still major lines that hadn't been climbed, but they, you know, people weren't, they were just starting to do things quickly. So it was a great, it was a time of great challenge and opportunity, I guess. But when I was there 2 summers ago, in summer 2016, in many ways it hadn't changed. Sure, the glacier had melted out a great deal, and I was seeing lakes where I'd never seen lakes before, 8,000 and 9,000 feet, huge melt out. There were many times where I had to pinch myself, where I felt like I was still, I could have been back in the 1976.
Wow.
Because when you're, it still snows, like I'll get out on the mountain, of course, in the Alaska Range. So you don't, you can't really see that melt out of it unless you're there late in the summer.
You know, those were, sounds like really formative times in your life. Who were some of the people, some of the characters that you ran into in Talkeetna and Denali that, that really made an impact on you and that you remember?
I've mentioned Reinhold Messner already, who was just a passing figure, came once to the mountain. But Peter Habler, his partner, the Austrian climber, came repeatedly to Denali, and I ran into him a couple of times. In terms of time spent with other people, there were people like Mug Stump, who I happened to spend a lot of time with in between climbs, kind of time where both of us were hanging out at the southeast fork of the Kihiltna, wondering what to do next. And Muggs was a huge inspiration in the way that all committed climbers are, you know, living the life, you know, basically setting up a tent for the summer on the southeast fork of the Kihiltna. And that was home to him. And he was his spirit was a huge inspiration, I'd have to say. But I love the international flavor of the mountain. And I remember a British military climber I met in 1984, whom I happened to see again on the mountain in 2016. And then all of my friends, it's just amazingly enough, Vern Tejas was still up there guiding as if he'd never left 25, 30 years later, coming back repeatedly. So many of the guides were close friends. And then there were people like Dave Johnston, sort of a generation before me, who did the first winter ascent in 1967 of the West Buttress. And I had the opportunity to do a couple of trips with Johnston, and a wonderful gentle giant, and other friends like Brian Auchinneck, whom I worked for his guiding company for a time. So it was a real, again, a very much a social scene.
Right.
I think that we all fed off of one another. There's a synergy of people there that kept us going, whom we would all conspire together.
In 1983, Waterman published his first book, Surviving Denali, a thorough study of the history of accidents on Denali, in a work he describes as his most important. This was followed in 1988 by High Alaska, a classic historical guidebook of routes on Denali, Foraker, and Hunter. And finally, in 1993, Waterman published In the Shadow of Denali, a book of short stories inspired by his personal experiences and the characters he encountered on and off the mountain. I asked John to talk about his experience writing In the Shadow of Denali and the commitment that is sometimes required to tell the whole story.
A lot of my drive and attraction to the mountain wasn't about simply climbing it. It was at first, and it quickly became drawn to a kind of a bigger picture, which is the picture that I had the luxury to describe in my book, In the Shadow of Denali. I was drawn to the idea of the mountain as being part of a greater whole, as being not just the tip of the wilderness, but integral with the wilderness. And so the experiences that gave me great joy weren't just climbing the mountain and being with other climbers on the mountain, but it was skiing into, dog sledding into, or skiing out and boating out of the mountain and getting to know the wilderness and having these incredible experiences miles from anywhere with communications equipment, really, frankly, in the 80s that was just worthless. So we're completely on our own. So to me, the draw was much greater than just the mountain. It was the wilderness experience and the idea that just the park alone that I was working for and then guiding in and then repeatedly returning to and then writing about was immense. And you could lose yourself there. And I still feel that I could go back. I am sure that I will, maybe not to climb the mountain again, but to circumnavigate it and to sort of try to incorporate all those experiences in one. To me, that was the attraction. And in terms of being a writer, In the Shadow of Denali was not my first book. It was my third book, I believe. And the books that preceded it were very deliberate. The first one was Surviving Denali, which is a study of accidents, which was just written. I was in shock at the mistakes that people made, that climbers made, repeating the mistakes of others again and again and again. So I wrote that book, basically, which should have the subtitle, How Not to Kill Yourself on the Highest Mountain in North America. And it's the most important book that I've ever done, really, my first book. I wanted to be a writer. I'd actually written a novel before that, which I never sold. So I was, from a fairly young age, drawn to power of language and words. I'm sort of drunk on language and books. So to write, to me, was to follow that great legacy of other writers who had inspired me. But it was a long, steep learning curve, and still is to this day. I wrote Surviving Denali, which was really just an epidemiology, a study of accidents. And then I wrote High Alaska, which was the second book that I did, which I was pleased to see people on the mountain are still consulting. People were even carrying the book with them, which gave me great joy, 35 years later, to see people carrying that book around, even though they were destroying it.
Right.
But that was my opportunity. I had agendas with those first two books. The agenda, first one, was to prevent people from killing themselves. And the second book was, I'm always distressed by how disinterested people seem to be in history. And that guidebook, High Alaska, that I wrote was an opportunity to share with people this rich history of not only Denali, but Foraker and Hunter. And so I became just utterly obsessed in the stories of my predecessors and friends and trying to capture a little bit of their character and their age and where they're at in life and how they pulled off these amazing climbs from Jed Williamson on the East Buttress in 1963 to Muggs Stump on the North Buttress of Hunter in 1981. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to know all these people. And I wrote letters, hundreds of letters, in order to write that book. This is in the day before email or the internet. So it was a great obsessive experience pulling that book together.
Right.
So in retrospect, I would have to say, you asked, how did I become a writer and how did I write In the Shadow of Denali? Well, I had to take on these great research projects first to really know the sort of the depth and the breadth of the mountain through its history and through the blunders people made getting hurt and killed on the mountain. And that allowed me to write this more expositional book of filled with characters and just my own experiences. I know that it's a popular book, maybe my most popular book, because it keeps getting reprinted, which is lovely. Although I'm still not convinced that a lot of climbers are interested in that, because the obsessional mindset of the climber who's in deep in the game, it doesn't allow us to sort of look outside and take in the big picture. To pull off, the Infinite Spur, or let alone the Kasin Ridge in winter, you have to be an obsessive fanatic. And sometimes that doesn't allow you to have a greater interest in these other things. So I think that book is a book for people that have a different interest than just climbing. And maybe that's why you appreciate it.
I don't know. I think there's an honesty, too, that I guess I really appreciate. You know, for instance, you know, I'm thumbing through the book right now, and the title story, In the Shadow of Denali, is, I just find it to be incredibly powerful. It's the kind of story, it's almost like a gut punch, because it's so honest. And it also paints a picture of kind of the dark underbelly of Alaska that some people don't see. Suicide, alcoholism, the long, dark winters, stuff like that. And I don't know why, for some reason, that really had an impact on me.
I appreciate that. I mean, and again, it's just my time on the mountain seems to be lumped in together with a myriad of experiences like that, with my neighbors, the Atwaters, and fishing for salmon and getting chased by bears. You know, they all rate just as high as crawling to the top of the Kasin Ridge in the middle of winter, sick.
Right. One of the other stories that I personally wanted to touch on is the story about the other John Waterman, which, again, is just, you know, to me, it's like a really classic story, the way you told it. And I was just really kind of blown away by the connection that you had with his father, Guy. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Guy Waterman was very much a mentor for me. I met him in, I believe it was 1974. That was 1974, 1975, the year that I graduated from high school, 74. And Guy was a mountaineering instructor for a winter mountaineering trip that I went on. And I think that my first memory of Guy is telling the story of his son, John, J-O-H-N, versus me, J-O-N, running from an avalanche with his Jumar open, trying to beat the avalanche to the fixed rope that he was running toward. And of course, he made it, but he didn't make it another time. And rather than telling that whole story, I'll answer your question specifically, and Guy was a mentor of mine, and he was a mentor because he embraced those qualities that I sought. You know, he was athletic and graceful and a master of his crafts, various crafts. He was like a cat on the rock or on ice, but he was also a genius. He was a great intellect. And of course, I was never turned off, but I was drawn to it. Curious and sort of like to bask in his intellect and his storytelling and also his gentleness. But I'm afraid to say that I crossed a bridge with Guy that I shouldn't have crossed and asked him to share the story of his son with me. And he did very generously through the course of several long letters and, of course, the stories that he told me in person. And that was the end of our friendship. I know that he felt betrayed by that. And I think that in the telling, I might have interpreted it wrong or might have revealed too much about him. And so not only did Johnny Waterman, his son, lose his life in the mountains, probably because he was very deliberately sought out to kill himself by marching off alone up a crevasse field toward the unclimbed route on Denali, but Guy also killed himself on a mountain because of depression that haunted him. And I'm certain that a lot of that depression stemmed from the loss of his sons, particularly Johnny.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty heavy.
So there is that is, in a sense, the second chapter of that story, which I didn't tell. Those things hadn't happened yet when I wrote that story. Guy was still alive. But I'm happy to say that I remain in close touch with his widow, Laura, who's a good friend of mine. And to come full circle on that story, I've since seen a genealogy. And Johnny Waterman was a cousin of mine, extraordinarily enough. We were related to one another, which I did not know when I wrote that story.
Wow.
And so all the kidding and the mistaken identities that I took for years, for instance, when I was guiding on the West Buttress in 1981, they were searching for Johnny on the other side of the mountain who disappeared. And every time I introduced myself to someone, "Oh, Johnny, they found you. I'm so glad you're alive." Not knowing that we're two entirely different people. But now, in retrospect, I've learned that he, in fact, was a third cousin of mine.
Wow.
So now the letters that are exchanged between Laura and myself, Laura was a stepmother to Johnny, but they open, "Dear Cuz." And I'm pleased to say that even though these are emails that we send to one another, they have the same sort of depth and length that our letters used to have back and forth to one another, right, when Guy was alive 25 years ago.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. And I guess I'm going to ask you a little bit of a personal question here, and it's totally up to you, you know, how much you want to talk about it. But it sounds like you and Guy, for whatever reason, had a falling out. How did you feel about that?
Well, in retrospect, of course, I'm very sad about it. I would like to have spent more time with him. But, you know, part of this goes toward what I decided to do with my life. And I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to tell the full story. I wanted to plumb to the depths of my subjects, whether it was people or my own shortcomings or sometimes my partners. Although if I did that, I always tried to be honest about myself too. But at any rate, how do I feel about that? Well, in addition to being sad, I also feel sort of resigned because I was fully committed to what I knew then, even 30 years ago, what I wanted to do for the rest of my life was to write. And I didn't want to do it in a half-assed way. I didn't feel bound to any particular code except the truth. And to come right out and be transparent about this, I had written a profile of Guy and Laura for Backpacker magazine called The Consciousness of the White Mountains. And I was quite proud of the story, but I at that point in time, I sent it to Guy and asked him to make sure that I got it right. And there was one thing that he corrected in the story. And what he corrected in the story was about an encounter that a sad encounter, meeting in his yard, and he mistook me for his son late at night. And he asked me to expunge that from the story because he said he didn't think that it happened. He thought it wasn't true. And I acquiesced for the sake of our friendship. But then when I wrote the story about Johnny, I decided I couldn't acquiesce because that happened to me. Being mistaken for his son happened to me. It was part of my experience, and I couldn't withhold that very powerful experience, this feeling of not only connection with Guy, but sense of sadness and his loss of his own son and mistaking me for his son.
Right.
It's just a road I chose to go down, and I guess I'm not sorry that I took it, but I'm sorry that I can no longer visit with him,
right,
as I can with Laura.
Right. Although his time on Denali was defining in many ways, it was a string of experiences in the Arctic that would push new personal boundaries of what was possible. Between 1997 and 1999, Waterman paddled 2,200 miles from Pacific to Atlantic tides on the Northwest Passage. This was a time of immense personal growth and self-discovery, and was documented in his 2001 book, Arctic Crossing. I asked John to reflect on this journey, what he learned along the way, as well as what the Arctic landscape means to him.
The most powerful experience I had was clearly this one trip that I did, told in my book, Arctic Crossing, 2,200-mile trip, mostly in a kayak, mostly alone, across the better part of the Northwest Passage. And I did that in the years 97 through 99. I made a film to help pay for it, basically filming myself, and occasionally a cinematographer would meet me in the villages and pull in a little more footage. But I've made mention already to a trip I did in Denali in the winter of 1982, climbing the Kasin Ridge, which is clearly the most dangerous thing I've ever done in my life. But this trip I did in the Arctic had elements of hazard to it that weren't so reliant on luck as I was on Denali in the winter time. But I was so extended physically and psychologically on that trip in the Arctic that it's never really left me alone. I'm still haunted by it. In fact, I still fantasize of going back and doing one more great solo in the Arctic. I don't know if I'll have the courage to pull it off or not, but that trip across the Arctic was memorable. I guess if I could compress it all into one powerful nut, I would say that the most powerful part of it was that I had this, I'd get to a village and resupply, and then I'd head out on my own, sometimes as far as 400 miles to the next village where I'd mail ahead some food, or I would pick up things at the little co-ops they had in those Inuit villages. But every time I left a village after being alone for a week or two or even more, I'd just go into this state of great anxiety and trepidation. And that, after about a week, I was strung so tightly that I would just suddenly just start to relax. I had no choice. I'd have to sleep. I went into this state of being that I've never really been in before. Certainly, I've approached it on mountaineering expeditions, but because I was alone and there were bears chasing me and other hazards, I had to constantly sort of be on my toes. And so I dropped into, for lack of better description, what I have to describe as some remnant instincts of my caveman or hunting ancestry, where I became acutely aware of everything around me. And it was quite powerful because I could repeatedly would figure out that there was a bear nearby when I wasn't aware of smelling it, certainly wasn't aware of seeing it or hadn't seen its tracks. And the other thing is that animals would come and approach me after I got into this state of relaxation in ways that they wouldn't in that first week leaving the village and leaving people. So clearly, this is what I was drawn to from the beginning as a teenager, was the opportunity to reach that point of self-sufficiency where I could be utterly self-sufficient in a hostile yet beautiful remote place. And,
right.
And that's what I found in the Arctic. And I couldn't have done that trip without my time on Denali, and certainly other mountains like Denali, because you spend time on cold mountains or out in the winter on extended trips, and you get good at being comfortable, not only in the cold, but with other sorts of, you learn to relax and conserve your energy.
Right.
So that trip in the Arctic for me was sort of a dream come true. And I still actually quite specifically fantasize of another trip that I want to do like that wow. one across the Northwest Passage.
Wow. Maybe just to talk about that just a little bit more, and maybe you just touched on it, but like, what is the most challenging thing that you faced on a trip like that?
I'd have to say it's the starting out, you know, that is actually putting that first foot forward. And that's the hardest part. And once you're there and that made those first steps, then once you're committed, then everything seems to fall in place. Not that I wasn't challenged again and again, but to me now in this position of wondering if I can pull off another trip, I'm confronted with that yet again, you know,
mm-hmm.
Can I really do this? And that challenge was very real in 1997. I had no idea if I could make it all the way from the Pacific to the Atlantic tides. And so I very wisely did the first summer as a small bite, just going 500 miles or so by myself, just to see if I could hack being alone and isolated for that long of a time. And when I finished that trip, I was so extended and shaken by it, I couldn't even think of continuing to do the remaining 500 or 1,500 or more miles. But after a couple of months went by, I realized that, you know, it really wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
I think it's like being a mountaineer, you know, we have bad memories and we tend to forget the hard parts and see the beauty and the challenge as things that we need.
Yeah.
So after doing that shorty trip, I committed myself to the rest of it. In other words, committing to it was, I then began to seek sponsors and financial support, where in that first summer, I just did it entirely on my own. I just drove my truck to the Arctic Ocean and started paddling.
You give up your traveling. Beyond the silhouettes. September sky.
I have to say, it was a full circle experience for me to connect with John 23 years after first reading In the Shadow of Denali. This was a book that inspired me as a wide-eyed alpinist fresh out of high school, a book that I found comfort in throughout the years when my life outside of the mountains threatened to overwhelm me, but mostly a book that made me feel like there were other people out there that understood me. Before we ended our conversation, I asked John to touch on his own full circle experience with the writing of his new book, Chasing Denali, and to touch on the things that are important to him in his life today.
I went back to Denali. I hadn't been there for 23 years in the summer of 2016. And I had the luxury of joining a Park Service patrol. So rather than having to mount my own expedition or go alone, which would have been a little bit more daring do than I wanted, I just joined a group. The challenging part, of course, is I knew nothing about my companions, and the ranger I had hoped to go with, Mark Westman, had cancer. So I went with another group entirely. So maybe one of the biggest challenges was just being thrown into a social situation that was strange and new. Moreover, I was with six other guys that were half my age. So the challenge was actually keeping these very fit guys in sight. It all worked out quite well. But another thing arose while I was on the mountain, and I have spoken about mentors and heroes and grandparents as being people we need as mountaineers to inspire us, or at least some of us do. And my heroes on Denali, in addition to David Johnson's and Mug Stumps, were three guys in 1910 called the Sourdoughs, who climbed the mountain in an 18-hour dash, round trip. The mountain had never been climbed. Granted, they went to the lower North Peak. But it occurred to me, and in talking to a couple of other experts on the mountain when I was there in 2016, that maybe this was a myth, because their feat had never been repeated. Not only had the couloir, the final couloir that they climbed, not been repeated, but that their time on that side of the mountain has never been repeated. So I decided to debunk their story. And I've written a book that looks into this great mystery of this inspirational 1910 sourdoughs, and built a narrative that is sort of the foundation of which is my own time on the mountain, just sort of one final climb of the mountain, looking back at some people I revered from ancient history to figure out whether they actually done it or not.
Well, I got to read the book. Luckily, I got one of the... You sent me an early copy digitally, which was really kind of you. I blasted right through that book. I wouldn't call myself like a connoisseur of Denali history, but I certainly enjoy reading the history. To think of these climbers back in the early 1900s, you know, mushing in from Kantishna, it just is astonishing to me to think about them even getting to the Muldrow Glacier, let alone getting to the top. So I've always been really fascinated with that. But what was the high point in which they left to go to the summit?
As far as can be determined, we're pretty certain that they left from 11,000 feet, which is the very base of Carson's Ridge and the head of the Muldrow Glacier, yeah. Just maybe a quarter mile, half mile short of the runout zone of the Harper Icefall.
Yeah.
So they went from 11,000 to, 19,450, I think, memory serves, in round trip in 18 hours. They had prepared the ridge with their shovels because it had snowed and they needed footsteps. And, of course, they had no ice axes. They had long pike poles, which is what lumberjacks use on the river, or firemen use pulling down burning timbers, firefighters.
Right.
And they had a 14-foot flag, 25-pound spruce pole over their shoulder, and a great American flag, or so the legend tells us.
Right.
And I encourage your listeners, if they're interested, to read the book and follow me through the mystery to determine whether they've done it or not.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about how that trip came about?
They were largely, after digging up every shred of evidence that I could find, they were hugely motivated by the fraud Dr. Frederick Cook, who claimed to climb the mountain several years before them. And no Alaskan believed that he did it because he was a chechako, that is, he was an outsider. He lived in a turreted mansion in New York and didn't know the ways of the land. And Alaskans figured that only a sourdough or a seasoned pioneer like themselves could do it. So they were very much driven to do this because they wanted to prove that what Alaskans were made of and that Cook had not done it. It took an Alaskan to do this great deed. But there were some other motivating factors as well. They, much like the modern dirtbag climber, they really had just the clothes on their back. At least three of the four of them did. And they needed funding to get back out to their mines in Kantishna. And so raising the money, $1,500, as it turned out, which is a huge sum in those days. That was worth over six figures today.
Oh, my God.
Allowed them to get back out to their mines. And so they had to go knock off the mountain before they could get back to work in their mines with all this seed money they had been given to climb the mountain.
Wow.
But also the fact that it was essentially their boss, Thomas Lloyd, who had gotten the sponsorship, whom they wanted to please because he was paying their bills. In this case, he was paying their bills and getting them out there and feeding them through sponsorship money to climb the mountain. So they had a secondary agenda, and depending on each of the three, we know for certain that Lloyd was lying because he was overweight and old, too old and overweight to climb the mountain, but insisted to his dying day that he had. And so the real question is, who of the other three did it, if they did it at all?
Right.
A remarkable feat. You know, it makes sense that they had all the tools. They spent all this time out in the wilds and in winter, cold, sub-zero remote conditions, that they certainly could handle all the approach, which is considerable in those days, even though there were no footprints or trail or photographs or route descriptions. But the more impressive thing, of course, is the climb, because none of them were climbers. So if they did it, it was an extraordinary feat. And again, I think that most readers will make up their mind after they put down my book.
Right, right. Well, the last thing that I wanted to ask you, two questions. You've lived a pretty remarkable life, and it certainly has been documented in the books that you've written. But really, you've done a lot of things in your life, and it seems like you still have things that you'd like to do. So my questions are, what's important to you today? And the second question is, what are some things that you would still like to do?
The thing that's most important to me is really my children. I have two sons. I have a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old, and they're my sunrise and my sunset in many ways. Unfortunately, I'm only living with one of them right now, my older son, Nicholas. And having children really changes your life in remarkable ways. Have loved most every minute of it, and to be able to send them forward into their own fulfilling lives and to do good in the world in whatever ways they might choose is just, it's one of the things that spins my clock more than anything else, as challenging as that can be at times, particularly now as a single father. In terms of my own ambitions, well, increasingly, first and foremost, a writer, and have been for more than 35 years. And so I'm still very much obsessed about language and the written word. And I want to try to leave behind my own contributions, but at the same time, I'm still very much in the game, even at 62. And I'd like to believe that I'm still in the game physically, too, because at 60, I felt probably stronger than I'd ever felt before at altitude and didn't have any trouble keeping up to guys half my age. So I'm not terribly interested in climbing any particular mountain these days, other than the local mountains with my sons, but I am interested in returning to the Arctic, and I don't want to give away what it is that I want to do, but it's I've had my eye on it now since 1997, since I met an Inuit elder who described a place to me. I've always wanted to go to that place. It's just maybe I will just go and simply visit the place rather than make a big expedition out of it. But I have a dream of doing another paddling trip, which might involve a lot of dragging my kayak on sea ice, or maybe not. I had a goal when I did my last Arctic trip, really, to write and learn about Inuit culture, which is what I did in my book, Arctic Crossing. Well, if I put together this next trip, my goal would be to show how the Arctic is the canary in the coal mine to changing climate in the world. Of course, it's a fact, but if you have someone that spends time in these places as a researcher might, or an adventurer, then you can really, perhaps I can inspire some people about what's really going on in the far north.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of John's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his immense alpine experience to your next trip in the mountains. To learn more about John's new book, Chasing Denali, you can head on over to his website, jonathanwaterman.com, or find it anywhere good books are sold. Don't forget to leave a review for the podcast on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. And if the Fernline adds value to your life, please consider becoming a monthly backer on Patreon. And finally, if you enjoy the music you hear on this podcast, you can check out more of my tunes on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line. You can follow me, cause I ain't gonna stay here. I keep changing right by your side. Follow me, cause I ain't gonna
keep changing right.